Two men rode into Meeker, Colorado. One of the men led another horse, and draped across that horse, a body. As they rode down Main Street, several of the townspeople stopped what they were doing to watch. Some came out of their stores and buildings to stand on the side of the street. In Dunnigan's barbershop, Ernie Peterson, who was waiting for a shave and a trim, happened to see the rider through the window.
I'll be damned.
What is it?
Dunnigan applied lather to the face of old Gil Tucker. Tucker was a veteran of the War of 1812.
It's Amos Bodine.
Bodine? The bounty hunter?
That's him, all right.
Dunnigan left his customer and walked out onto the front porch, followed by Peterson and Gil Tucker. Tucker, whose face was half-lathered, was still wearing the barber apron Dunnigan put around him.
Who's that with him?
You mean the one riding with him? Or the fella he's bringing in?
Both.
I expect the one with him is a fella by the name of Colby. I've heard Colby is his partner. I don't have no idea who the one draped over the horse is.
Yeah, well, they say that Bodine ain't none too particular. If you want it, no matter what the reward is, he'll bring you in. And most of the time when he does bring someone in, he's dead.
When the horseman passed by the saloon, Colby pulled over and dismounted, then tied his horse to the hitching rail.
I'll be back in a few minutes.
I'll be in the saloon.
By the time Bodine reached the sheriff's office, Sheriff Adams had already heard about his arrival and was standing on the front porch waiting for him. Bodine stopped in front, then rode back to the trail horse. He leaned over to cut a rope, then gave the body that was draped over the saddle a push, and the body landed on the dirt street, face up, his arms thrown out to either side. His eyes were still open but opaque. His face had a bluish tint.
Sheriff, I'm...
Amos Bodine. Yeah, I know who you are.
Sheriff Adams nodded toward the body on the ground.
Who is that?
His name is Wright. Cleo Wright.
Bodine pulled a piece of paper from his pocket.
I got a Dodger here, says he's worth $250.
Did you have to kill him?
Read what it says on the paper. It says dead or alive.
I'm sure it does. It's not what I asked. I asked if you had to kill him.
He drew on me.
They always draw on you, don't they, Bodine?
I reckon they figure that's better than going to jail.
And it makes it easier for you to bring them in, doesn't it?
Some.
How many have you killed, Bodine?
25 or 30, I reckon. I really don't know. But I've never killed anyone that I didn't get paid for killing.
I'm sure you haven't.
Speaking of which, when am I going to get paid for this one?
Bodine nodded toward Cleo Wright.
It'll be a day or two before I can get you money.
It's fine by me, as long as I get it. My partner, Colby, is already down to the saloon. If you need me, I'll be there. I can wait.
You got a partner now.
It's come in handy a time or two.
Bodine turned his horse to ride away.
Bodine!
Yeah?
I don't want any trouble in this town. You hear me? I don't want any trouble in my town.
Sheriff, let me get this straight. Are you saying that if I see a wanted man in Meeker, I can't go after him?
Yes. No.
Yes or no what?
Just don't cause any trouble in my town.
When they rode into Meeker, Matt took a good look around. It had been several months since Matt had been in any town, and he had not really seen that many western towns, so he had no real way of judging this one. Someday, such towns would become the means of defining his life. Like mileposts, he would move from one town to another, each with a different name and with different people, but all with the same personality. And in some strange way that he could neither comprehend nor explain, he seemed to sense that now. This town was called Meeker, and it sat at the junction of Sulphur Creek and the White River. No railroad served the town, and its few streets were dotted liberally with horse droppings. The buildings of the little town were as washed out and fly-blown up close as they seemed from some distance. The first building they rode by was a blacksmith shop. A tall and muscular man bent over his anvil working a piece of metal. They rode by a butcher shop, a general store, a leather goods shop, and an apothecary. Next to the apothecary was a building that had a sign reading, Assay Office. They stopped. Matt looked at the sign with a curious expression.
What is an assay office?
You know all the panning we've been doing this summer?
Yes.
Well, this is where it pays off. This is where we're going to get some money.
So Swinging down from his horse, Smoke took the saddlebags down from his horse.
Let's go see how he did.
Matt dismounted and followed Smoke into the little building. Smoke dumped the gold nugget contents of his saddlebags out onto a wood counter. Matt knew that this was only a portion of what they had panned over the last 3 months. The rest of it was buried in cans around Smoke's cabin, with Smoke being careful to show Matt where each can was buried. The man behind the counter wore a white shirt, buttoned to the neck. He was wearing a collar, too, but the collar was askew. Rimless glasses perched on his forehead, but as he saw the nuggets dumped from the saddlebags, he moved the glasses down to his eyes, then positioned them with his forefinger.
Oh, my, oh, my, oh, my, oh, my!
Is that good, Smoke? Why does he keep saying, oh, my?
You'll see.
The man with the glasses picked up a magnifying glass and looked more closely at the rocks.
It's gonna take me a while to figure out how much all this is worth.
Is it worth enough for you to advance my partner and me $40 apiece right now?
Oh, heavens yes! It's worth much, much more than that.
Give me a receipt for the ore. Less $80. We'll be back for the rest of the money later.
The assayer wrote out a receipt, then handed Smoke four $20 bills. Smoke gave two of the bills to Matt.
No.
Matt shook his head and handed it back.
This is your money.
Are you saying you didn't have anything to do with panning it? Are you saying you didn't feed and water the animals? You didn't chop firewood? You didn't bring in water? You didn't do any hunting?
Well, yeah, I did all that, but...
No buts. We're full partners in this operation.
From the assayer's office, they went to a cafe for lunch. Although he had spent 3 years eating in a dormitory, this was the first cafe that Matt had ever been in his life. A very large woman saw them come in and gave them a big smile.
Smoke Jensen, you old heartbreaker, you! I see you survived another winter in the mountains.
Yeah, that I did, Julie. That I did.
Julie looked at Matt.
Well, now. Either Preacher has found some elixir that made him get really young, or you've got yourself a new partner. This sure don't look like Preacher.
This is my friend, Matt.
Matt is ever bit as good-looking as you are. You been hiding something from me, Smoke? Have you gone off and spawned a young'un of your own?
Afraid not. But I wouldn't be ashamed to claim Matt as my own. He's a fine young man.
I can tell that just by looking. Well, come on in and sit yourself down. What'll you have, Matt?
What will I have?
To eat. Well, what do you want to eat?
I'm not particular. Whatever you fix for supper, I'll eat it.
Well, you have to be more specific than that.
Maybe this'll help you.
Smoke picked up a menu and showed it to Matt.
You can have a ham, roast beef, fried chicken, pork chops, meatloaf.
All that? Who could eat all that?
You've never been in a cafe before, have you?
Matt shook his head.
You don't order all of it. You just order what you want.
Anything I want?
Sure.
I want fried chicken and apple pie.
You want potatoes with your chicken?
Matt shook his head.
All I want is fried chicken and apple pie.
Well, hon, that's not a very...
You heard him, Julie. Bring him some fried chicken and apple pie.
At the next table, someone got up and, as he was leaving, handed a newspaper to Smoke.
Here's the latest paper, friend, if you would care to read it.
Thank you.
He read the paper for a few minutes, then glanced across the table toward Matt.
The full name of the man you're looking for is Clyde Payson.
What? How did you know that? Is it in the paper?
See for yourself.
Smoke handed the paper to Matt.
Dastardly deeds in Cedar Creek. Bank robbers kill teacher and a child. Leave one of their own dead. On the 5th, a band of bank robbers led by desperado Clyde Payson rode into the small town of Cedar Creek, Colorado. In a daring daylight robbery, the thieves relieved the Bank of Cedar Creek of its cash reserves, equaling at the time a little over $6,000. Told of their presence by an alert citizen, Marshal Jeremiah D. Cobb established wagon barricades at either end of the street with the intent of preventing the robbers from getting out of town. However, the desperados managed to escape by riding through a schoolyard, which at the time was crowded with children at play. Miss Margaret Miller, a beloved matron and longtime schoolteacher, as well as little Holly McGee, one of her second grade students, were both killed in the gun battle that ensued. Also killed was Pete Liu, one of the robbers. Clyde Payson is described as being a peculiarly ugly man. He is 5'9" tall, with a purple scar that starts at his forehead, disfigures the left eye, then proceeds unabated down his cheek and jawline, till it pulls the left side of his mouth into a sneer. One other member of the gang has also been identified as Garvey Laird. Laird is easily identified by the fact that during the war, a mini-ball diminished his left ear by one half. Readers are cautioned not to approach any of these men as they are very dangerous. Should one of them be seen, a county sheriff or United States Marshal should be informed of their whereabouts. Marshal Cobb reminds readers not to inform him, as he has no jurisdiction beyond the town limits of Cedar Creek.
Matt tapped the newspaper article with his finger.
That's them. They're the ones who killed my Ma, Pa, and sister.
If they stay this active, you won't have much trouble finding them. Unless somebody else kills them first.
I don't care who kills them, as long as they're dead.
After the cafe meal, they went to a general store where Matt bought 3 pairs of jeans, 3 shirts, some underwear, socks, and boots.
My, what a large purchase. It's almost as if you were starting from scratch.
I am starting from scratch.
The shopping done, Smoke took Matt to one of the saloons.
There's a way of entering saloons, though you don't have any need to do so now. The time will come when it will serve you well. So you may as well learn how to do it now.
All right.
Following Smoke's lead, Matt went through the batwing doors into the saloon and stepped immediately to one side with his back at the door.
You always take a good look around.
What are we looking for?
You'll know it if you see it.
Matt saw it almost as quickly as Smoke. A rather gaunt-looking man with a sweeping handlebar mustache stood at the far end of the bar. He saw them both in the mirror. He reached down and slipped his pistol out of his holster, then held it down out of sight alongside his leg. The man did it quietly and unobtrusively, and neither looked around nor made any sign of recognition. Had Smoke and Matt not been making it a point to study everyone in the saloon, neither of them would have seen it. Because of their diligence, both saw it.
Smoke, you see it, boy. Step away from me. Move to the other side of the door. Keep your back to the wall.
Matt had only been with Smoke for about 6 months now, but he knew enough to do exactly as Smoke asked, without question. The man at the bar set down his drink without turning to Smoke.
Mister, would your name be Jensen? Smoke Jensen?
That's me.
I've seen paper on you. The paper says you are a murderer and a low-life son of a bitch.
These were challenging words. Words that even Matt knew were killing words. Everyone at the bar knew so as well, because almost as one, they broke away from the bar and scrambled quickly to get out from between the two men.
Are you the law?
Nah, I ain't the law. The law can't collect rewards.
I guess that makes you a bounty hunter.
That's what I am, all right. And you are worth $1,500 to me.
No, I'm not. The paper on me got called back, so I'm worth nothing to you, even if you could take me in.
Well, I don't plan on taking you in. I plan on just killing you right here, having a sheriff vouch for it so as I can collect me that reward.
What's your name?
Bodine. Amos Bodine. I reckon you've heard of me.
Bodine, we don't have to do this. You can just walk away now, and nobody has to get hurt. I told you, there's no reward.
Well, now, maybe there is a reward and maybe there isn't. That still leaves you a murdering low-life son of a bitch.
Is there any way I'm going to be able to talk you out of this?
Smoke's question surprised and disappointed Matt.
Is Smoke scared? I never thought Smoke would run scared.
Almost as soon as he thought it through, he felt ashamed of himself.
What am I thinking? Smoke saved my life. He kept me alive through the winter. Smoke shared his gold secret with me. And right now, I'm standing here with about $30 in my pocket. That's more money than I ever held at any one time in my life. What am I doing questioning anything Smoke does?
At the bar, Bodine just shook his head. He still hadn't turned around to face Smoke.
Ain't gonna be able to talk your way out of this one, mister. The reward says you are worth $1,500, dead or alive, and I intend to collect.
Then I expect it's time to killing started.
His hand full of cocked pistol, Bodine swirled away from the bar. Smoke drew, fanned the hammer back, and fired in one fluid motion. Matt saw Bodine gasp in surprise as the bullet from Smoke's gun plunged into his chest. Bodine staggered back and fell flat on his back on the floor of the saloon. His gun arm was thrown to one side, the still unfired pistol in his hand. Even as Bodine fell, Smoke fired a second time. Looking up, Matt saw someone tumble over the railing at the top of the stairs. The second man had been holding a rifle, and the rifle fell before him, reaching the floor an instant before the man did. Matt had not even seen him until this moment, and he was amazed Smoke had. Smoke stood in place for a long moment, holding the discharged gun in his hand, while a little stream of smoke drifted up from the end of the barrel.
Holy shit! Did you see that?
And I thought Bodine was fast.
I need a drink.
The man led a mad rush to the bar.
Matt, are you all right over there?
Yes, I'm fine.
Get us a table, and I'll get you a sarsaparilla.
I'd rather have a beer.
You might rather have a beer, but you're getting a sarsaparilla.
Yeah, that's what I said. I'd like to have a sarsaparilla.
I thought that was what you said.
Matt found a table and sat down.
Whoa, did you see that?
Matt listened to the man at the next table.
Of course I seen it. I was in here when it happened, wasn't I?
He beat Amos Bodine. I didn't think anyone would ever be able to beat Amos Bodine.
Hell, he beat Bodine and the man he was riding with.
What's the name of the fellow that shot Bodine?
Jansen. Smoke Jansen. He's standing right behind me, isn't he?
The sheriff was in the saloon almost before the gun smoke drifted away. He saw the two men lying on the floor. Then he walked over at the table where Smoke was rejoining Matt with a beer in one hand and Matt's pop in the other. Smoke and the sheriff pulled out chairs and sat down.
Hello, Sheriff Adams.
Adams nodded toward the two dead men.
I see you got Bodine and Colby.
Colby, huh? I was wondering who it was. I got the chance to ask him his name.
Adams stared at Smoke for a moment. Then he saw the humor of the statement.
Well, it's too late to make friends now.
What were they in town for? Surely they weren't here just to kill me.
Nope. He just came in today, bringing a body for claim. He would have been gone by tomorrow once the money came in. If you had waited one more day before coming in, you two wouldn't have run into each other.
If not now, later. People like Bodine don't seem to care much whether the reward poster is still good or not.
I reckon not.
The sheriff looked over at Matt, then stroked his chin as he studied him.
Who'd you say this young man was?
I didn't say who he was, but he's my partner.
Well, the reason I asked is I got a letter from the sheriff in Soda Creek. Seems a boy ran away from the home up there.
The home?
Home for wayward boys and girls.
You don't say. What about this boy that ran away? What did he do?
He ran away.
No, I mean, why was he in the home? Had he stolen from someone?
No, I don't know whether he stole anything or not. The letter didn't say anything about that. It just said that he ran away from the home.
You got a name for the boy that ran away?
The sheriff said his name is Matt.
You don't say. Well, now, that's a coincidence. My partner's name is Matt. But he sure doesn't belong in a home for wayward boys and girls.
No, I reckon not.
Smoke looked over at the two bodies. By now, Lenny Holman, the town undertaker, had arrived and was looking at the two men, gauging the size of the coffins he would have to make.
Are you going to need me for a hearing or anything?
Nah, I don't think so. I know Bodine, and there's no doubt in my mind what happened here. Also, there are enough eyewitnesses to give me all the statements I need.
Well, if you do need me, Matt and I are going to spend today and tomorrow in town.
Enjoy your stay.
With a final nod, Sheriff Adams left the table, then went over to start talking to the eyewitnesses. There are many who saw it happen, and nearly all were eager to tell their story.
I don't mind telling you. I was a little nervous when you told the sheriff that my name was Matt.
Well, I had to tell him. Otherwise, I might have tripped up and called you Matt. Best to get that part out in the open.
And then when you said I didn't come from the home, well, I...
That's not what I said.
What?
I didn't lie. What I said was, my partner's name is Matt, but he sure doesn't belong in a home for wayward boys and girls. I didn't say you didn't come from there.
No, I guess you didn't.
Matt turned the sarsaparilla up to his lips, then looked across the table toward Smoke.
You know, someday I hope to be as fast with a gun as you are.
Why? So you can kill Payson?
No. I mean, yes, I am going to kill Payson. That's not the reason I want to be fast with a gun.
What is the reason?
I don't know exactly. Maybe it's just because I would like to be really good at something.
Smoke smiled at his young friend.
Well, that's a good enough reason.
Und What do you think about this one, young sir?
The gunsmith handed a pistol to Matt. The first place they went after leaving the saloon was a gunsmith shop.
It's a beauty.
Matt held the pistol gingerly in his hand as he looked at it.
What kind is it?
It is a model 1861 Colt, manufactured at the Colt Firearm Factory in Hartford, Connecticut.
Yeah, take a look at the markings on the gun.
Matt studied the markings. On the barrel was stamped, address, COL period, SAML Colt, New York, U.S., America. The left front side of the frame was marked Colt's Patton. The caliber marking, 36 cal, was stamped on the left rear side of the trigger guard.
You like it?
Yes.
We'll take it. And a gun belt and holster rig.
Yes, sir. Would you like it wrapped or in a box?
Smoke looked at Matt and smiled.
I'm sure he would much rather wear it.
Yes, I would rather wear it.
Then wear it you shall, young sir.
The gunsmith selected a belt and handed it to Matt. Matt put the belt on, then slipped the gun down into the holster.
All right, let's see you draw.
Matt drew the pistol as fast as he could.
What is it? What did I do wrong?
Well, let's start with what you did right.
All right. What did I do that was right?
You didn't drop it.
That's it? I didn't drop it?
That's it. Everything else you did was wrong.
Will you teach me?
Yeah, I'll teach you.
When you shot that bounty hunter, that was the fastest draw I ever saw.
Was it?
Sure was.
How many fast draws have you seen?
Well, I guess that's the only one I've ever seen.
Then it isn't very hard to be the fastest, is it?
Are you the fastest?
Well, I don't know. There are some out there who are very fast. Wild Bill Hickok, Payson Allison, Ian McAllister, Angus Boone.
I've heard of Hickok, Allison, and McAllister. I never heard of Angus Boone. Who's he?
Well, some people call him the Grave Digger.
Is he fast?
Very fast. And he's one of those rare people who kills for the sake of killing.
Why would someone do that?
Because he likes killing.
Well, I wouldn't enjoy killing, but I do want to be fast.
Being fast means nothing if you can't hit what you're shooting at. First thing we have to do with you is teach you how to shoot.
I can shoot. I used to go squirrel hunting back when I was only 8 or 9 years old. I could hit them, too.
But you were using a rifle then, right? Or maybe a shotgun.
A shotgun.
Well, that's pretty good. But now you have to learn how to use a handgun. And that's very different. Are you willing to learn?
Yes.
Good. Take off your holster and give it to me.
What? Why?
Because you don't need it right now. And I don't even want you thinking about it. This is shooting, not fast draw.
Whatever you say.
Matt unbuckled his gun and gave it to Smoke.
All right. Show me what you can do.
Smoke looked around and found a rusty can. Then stepped off about 30 yards and placed the can on a rock. He walked back to Matt.
Shoot that can.
Matt pulled the trigger. The bullet kicked up dirt well to the side of the rock where the can was sitting.
I missed.
Try again.
Matt thought the can smirked at him.
Here, let me see what we can do to help.
Smoke put his hands on Matt's shoulders. He turned the boy to a position of about 45 degrees from the target.
Now, don't turn your body. But look at the target by turning your head and eyes only.
Matt responded.
Bring the pistol up to eye level and sight on the target. Then, close your eyes. Raise your pistol and arm straight up. And with your eyes still closed, bring your arm back down until it feels to you as if you lined up with the target.
Like this?
Matt did as instructed.
Yes.
Matt let his arm come back down, then he opened his eyes. He was almost perfectly aligned.
It's there.
Good. Now, spread your feet apart. About the width of your shoulders. Keep your legs straight, but not stiff. Think you can do that?
Matt adjusted his legs and feet, then looked at Smoke.
Yes, I can do it.
Okay, what are you going to do with the other arm?
I don't know. What should I do?
Forget that it's there. It should be totally relaxed.
All right.
Now, again, look at your target by turning your head and eyes slightly without moving from the neck down. Once you're looking at it, raise your pistol so you can sight on the target. You should feel that the pistol is hanging from above, and not that you're pushing it up from below.
Again, Matt complied with Smoke's instructions.
Are you aiming at the target now?
Yes.
Shoot.
Hey! I did it!
Smoke made Matt practice shooting every day for the next month. Matt was a natural shooter, and he hit the can so many times that toward the end of his shooting, rather than reset the can, he just continued to shoot it, knocking it about the meadow. Then one day, Smoke came out to watch him. He stood there for a few minutes, nodded, then went back into the cabin. When he returned, he was carrying the pistol belt. He handed the holster rig to Matt.
Put it on.
All right.
Empty your gun.
Empty it?
You don't want to shoot yourself in the leg while you're practicing.
I don't want to shoot myself in the leg either.
Matt poked the cartridges out of the revolver. He put the empty gun back into his holster.
I'm going to show you how to draw. First, I'll do it fast. Then, I'll do it slow, so you can see what I'm doing.
Smoke drew his pistol, fired, and put the pistol back in his holster. It happened so fast that even though Matt was watching, he couldn't see the actual draw. He saw only a quick jump.
Now, I'll do it slow.
Smoke eased the pistol from his holster. As he was doing so, his left hand came across his body to fan back the hammer. He pulled the trigger when the gun came in line with the target. The gun traveled just enough distance to clear the holster.
You didn't bring the gun up to aim it?
No, I didn't. I aimed before I drew the gun.
Matt thought for a second, then nodded.
Yeah, I know that doesn't sound like it makes sense, but I think I know what you mean.
Matt, it all comes down to this. The time is going to come when you'll just think the gun into your hand and the bullet into your target. The arm, the hand, the trigger finger are no longer there. They're just an extension of your mind. You think draw and shoot, and your mind will draw and shoot the gun for you.
How do you do that?
Do you think about breathing?
No, I just breathe.
Think about breathing.
It's harder when you think about it.
When you can draw and shoot a gun the same way you breathe, you'll be ready. Now, let me show you something.
Smoke checked Matt's pistol again to make sure it was empty. Then Smoke emptied his own gun, checking each chamber in the cylinder again. He put his gun back in his holster.
Point your gun at me. When you see me start to draw, pull a trigger.
Do you think I'm so slow that you have to give me that much of a head start?
Just do it.
All right.
Matt raised the pistol and aimed it at Smoke. Smoke drew his pistol, fanned the hammer, and pulled the trigger before Matt could pull the trigger on his own gun.
Wait, I wasn't ready.
We'll try it again.
They did it several times, and Smoke beat Matt every single time.
How did you do that?
Don't be so impressed. It was easy.
Because I'm so slow?
No, you could be faster than I am. I would still beat you.
Matt shook his head.
Wait a minute, that doesn't make any sense. If I was faster than you, how would you beat me?
Remember when I said you had to think your gun into your hand?
Yes.
Thinking about it takes longer than actually doing it. See, when you saw me start my draw, you had to think to pull the trigger. But I'd already thought about it. I'd already thought the gun into my hand.
That's amazing.
No, it's just a fact. But it might save your life someday.
I see.
All right. Now put your pistol back in your holster. Start working on your draw.
When can I load my pistol?
Now I'll let you know when.
For 2 weeks, Matt drew and pulled the trigger to an empty pistol. Then Smoke let him start drawing and shooting. Before the first snow, Matt was good enough to perform a few shooting tricks. With tin cans put on posts set 50 yards apart, Matt stepped halfway between the two. He stood there, his gun in his holster, looking over at Smoke.
Are you ready?
I'm ready.
Smoke held a rock out over a pie pan. Matt watched Smoke's hand. Smoke opened his hand to let the rock fall.
You got both shots off in under a second.
Is that pretty good?
Yeah, that's very good.
How good?
Well, what do you mean?
Well, how many do you think are faster?
Doesn't matter how many are faster.
What do you mean it doesn't matter how many are faster?
It doesn't matter. There may be some who are faster. There probably are some who are faster. But you have now reached the point to where the speed of your draw is no longer a consideration.
What is?
Smoke ran a hand through his hair before he answered.
I've held this for last, Matt. What I'm about to tell you is the final secret of the gunfighter. And I'm sorry to say, it's a terrible secret.
What's the secret?
At this level, being fast or accurate is not the differing factor. At this level, everyone is fast and everyone is accurate. But not everyone is willing to kill.
What?
The average man will pause, hesitate for just a heartbeat, before the pull of the trigger that he knows is going to kill. In a situation like that, the victory goes to the man who will not hesitate.
Yes. Yes, I see what you mean.
I hope you do see. Because being able to see and understand that will keep you alive.
How do you overcome it?
You have one thing going for you. You've had it going for you from the beginning. And if you hadn't had it, I don't think I would have taught you how to use a gun at all.
What? What do I have going for me?
You've already killed.
Matt was quiet for a moment.
I'm not proud of that, Smoke.
Nor should you be. Matt, the fact that you've killed is not a matter of pride, but it's a matter of survival.
Survival?
Yes. I want you to think about it every day. I want you to know that if you have to do it, you can kill a man without a second thought.
All right.
There's one more thing I want you to remember. Remember our talk about knighthood?
Yes, I remember.
Matt, you now have an awesome power. You have the power of life and death. Only God and the righteous should ever have such power. You are God, so you must be righteous. Be a knight, Matt. Never abuse this power you have now.
I won't.
Swear to me, Matt. Swear on the graves of your Ma and Pa that you will be a knight.
I swear to you, Smoke. I will be a knight.
The little town was hot, dry, and dusty. It grew up in the middle of nowhere and now sat baking in the sun like a lizard. To the six riders approaching from the north, the collection of adobe and sun-bleached wooden buildings was so much a part of the land that it looked almost as if the town was a result of some natural phenomenon rather than the work of man. Out on the edge of town, a sign read, "You are entering Gehenna. Population unknown. The law ain't welcome. If you got no business here, get out or get shot." On first glance, Gehenna looked like just about any other town in this part of the country. But that was on first glance only. A closer observation showed many differences. Gehenna was a town that existed not in spite of having no law, but because it had no law. It was a robber's roost, an outlaw's haven. And Clyde Payson, Garvey Laird, Clem Tyson, Bart Ebersol, Polk Lawson, and Sil Richards were drawn to it for just that reason. Clem Tyson took off his hat and wiped his brow with the back of his forearm.
I'm so thirsty, I'm spitting dust. I aim to get me two beers and drink them before I even take a breath. I aim to get me a good meal and a bottle of whiskey, then the best-looking whore in town. What's so damn funny, Poke?
There ain't gonna be no good-looking whores in Gehenna.
Why not?
'Cause whores that's still good-looking can make a living somewhere else. They don't have to come to a place like Gehenna.
Then what the hell we coming here for?
We ain't here for the whores. We're here because there's no law here.
No law, Tall.
Only the law that we make.
As the six men rode into town, not one person gave them a second look. Stopping in front of the single saloon, they dismounted. A tall man, dressed all in black, stepped out onto the front porch and looked down at him.
You're Payson, ain't you? Clyde Payson?
Yeah. You heard of me?
I heard of you.
Payson smiled and looked at the others.
What do you think, boys? I'm famous.
You come here to stay away from the law?
That's right.
Payson was still standing beside his horse so that it was between him and the man addressing him.
It'll cost you $100 to stay here.
$100? Says who?
Says me. You might say I'm the sheriff here. It's my job to collect taxes from those who come to enjoy our hospitality.
You're the sheriff? I thought there wasn't no law here.
The man spat a stream of tobacco, then wiped his lips with the back of his hand.
Well, now that ain't entirely true. We ain't got no courts or judges or jails or such, but we do have me.
And who are you?
Name is Loomis. Frank Loomis.
Payson was quiet for a moment before he answered.
Loomis? Frank Loomis. Yeah, I heard of you. You used to be a sheriff, didn't you? Then you had a run-in with a U.S. Marshal. You killed him, I believe. Now you're a wanted man yourself. So how come you're still sheriffing?
It's a different kind of sheriffing here. And I make a lot more money sheriffing here than I did back in Colorado.
Who pays you, the town?
No, the town don't pay me nothing. I pay myself.
I see. So the $100 you're asking for in tax, that's just to go to you, right?
You understand, I'm sure. If I'm going to pay myself to protect the town, then I have to charge a tax. I don't think $100 is asking too much.
Then what if I say I ain't going to pay it?
then you aren't eligible for the protection of the town. So I'll just ask you to move on.
What if I say I ain't gonna pay it and I don't plan to move on?
If you heard of me, then you know that I can back up what I say.
Unnoticed by Loomis, Payson had snaked his shotgun from the saddle holster. He now held the gun behind the horse to shield it from Loomis's view.
Are you saying we ain't never gonna be able to work this out?
Not unless you pay the $100 tax.
Loomis pushed his coat flap back, exposing his pistol.
Either pay it or get. You ain't got no other choice.
No, I reckon there is another choice.
In a quick, smooth action, Payson raised the shotgun up, laid the barrel across his saddle, and pulled the trigger. Loomis wound up lying on the floor with his chest opened up so that his insides could be seen. He never touched his pistol. Payson stepped into the saloon right behind Loomis's body. He carried the shotgun with him, a little curl of smoke streaming up from the end of the barrel.
Anybody else want to talk to me about paying taxes?
Nobody answered. In fact, nobody even looked at him.
Yeah, I thought this might be the end of it.
Payson set the butt of the shotgun on the bar with the barrel pointed up.
Bartender, what do you have to drink in this place?
Beer and whiskey.
I'll have it.
You'll have what, sir?
Beer and whiskey.
And we'll have the same.
Garvey indicated the rest of Payson's group.
Very good.
The bartender set up 6 empty whiskey glasses and a bottle of whiskey. A moment later, he set down 6 mugs of beer.
That'll be $6.50.
$6.50? $6.50 for what?
$5 for the bottle of whiskey and a quarter apiece for the beer.
That's outrageous to charge so much. I can get a beer for a nickel anywhere else in the country. Why should I pay you so much for it?
Because you ain't anywhere else in the country. You're here, and here, beer is 25 cents.
Payson pulled enough money from his pocket to pay for the beer and the whiskey. Payson tossed the whiskey down, then chased it with almost half the beer. He sat the beer glass down as well and looked toward the body of the man he had just killed.
Now what happens to him now? Does he just stay there and rot?
No, we learned just real quick that in a town like Ahina, we was going to need an undertaker. So we went out and hired us one.
Hey, what about whores? You got any whores?
Hell yes, we got whores. What good would a place like this be without whores?
Which one is the best looking?
Hell, nearly every whore in town would make a train take 5 miles of dirt road. But I reckon Jolene is somewhat better looking than most.
Where's she at?
The bartender didn't answer, but he pointed to a table in the back of the room. There was someone sitting there holding a whiskey bottle in one hand and a glass in the other.
Jolene! You got some business.
Jolene filled the glass one more time, then tossed the whiskey down before she walked up to the bar.
You wanting to ride me, cowboy?
How much?
$2.
$2? Damn, ain't that a little high?
Jolene turned to sashay back to her seat at the back of the room.
No, wait. I got $2.
In that case, I got me a room upstairs.
Jolene pointed toward the stairs at the back.
Oh, wait a minute.
Clem turned to the bartender.
Give me a bottle. I'm gonna have to pay $2. I plan to make it a party.
The bartender gave Clem a bottle in exchange for a $5 bill. Then, clutching the bottle by the neck, Clem followed Jolene up the stairs.
Who's in charge around here?
If you mean do we have a mayor or something like that, we ain't.
But somebody's in charge. Somebody always has to be in charge.
There was somebody in charge, but you just killed him.
Really? Well, then I reckon that sort of makes me the head man around here then, doesn't it?
I suppose so. That is until...
Until what?
Until the gravedigger comes back.
Gravedigger? You mean Angus Boone? Boone is here?
Not all the time. But when he is here, he's in charge. Unless you want to challenge him.
No, that's all right. The gravedigger can be in charge while he's here, and I'll be in charge while I'm here.
What if you're both here at the same time?
We won't be.
Two young men passing through Durango, Colorado, stopped in front of the Sundown Saloon. Swinging down from the horses, they patted their dusters down.
Donnie, you're as full of shit as a Christmas goose. There ain't nobody that lives on the moon.
How do you know? There ain't nobody ever gone up there to see that there ain't folks up there.
Yeah, well, that's my point. There ain't nobody up there because there ain't no way to get there.
How did we get here?
What?
How did we get here?
What do you mean, how do we get here? We've always been here.
Well, they've always been there.
No, they ain't.
You know your problem, Bobby Joe? Your problem is you ain't got no imagination.
Yeah, well, right now, I can imagine what a cold beer tastes like. And if we wasn't standing out here in the road arguing over whether or not there's people on the moon, which, if you ask me, is about the dumbest thing you can argue about, we'd be drinking a beer right now.
You got that right. It don't make no sense to be standing out here jawing when we could be inside drinking.
The two young men went into the saloon and stepped up to the bar. The saloon was relatively quiet, with only four men at one table and a fifth standing down at the far end of the bar. The four at the table were playing cards. The one at the end of the bar was nursing a drink. The man nursing the drink was dressed in black. A turquoise and silver band around his short-crowned black hat provided the only bit of color.
What'll it be, gents?
I want the coldest beer you got.
Every beer I have is the coldest one I have.
I'll have the same.
Two beers it is.
The bartender turned to draw the beers.
What brings you boys to Durango?
Nothing in particular. We're just passing through.
We're up from Texas.
The bartender put the beers in front of the two boys, and they each picked up one.
Yes, sir. The great state of Texas.
Well, welcome to Colorado.
The man at the end of the bar studied his drink.
Nothing good ever come out of Texas.
Using the back of a hand, Donnie wiped beer foam from his mouth. It was obvious that he had been irritated, and for the briefest of moments, that irritation reflected in his face. But he put it aside, then forced a smile.
Hell, mister, Texas is a big state. You can't say you don't like Texas unless you've seen all of it. And I know you ain't seen all of it, because no one's seen all of it.
Is that how you get around people telling you they don't like your state?
Bobby Joe had not been a part of the conversation, but he was listening to it.
What the hell, mister? You trying to pick a fight or something?
Why? If I was trying to pick a fight, would you be obliging me?
The way the man in black responded angered Bobby Joe even more.
Hell yes, I'd be willing to oblige you. Nobody up these parts knows me. But if they did know me, they'd be quick to tell you that Bobby Joe Brewbreaker ain't a man you want to get on the wrong side of.
You don't say.
Donnie recognized the growing danger before Bobby Joe did, and he reached out his hand to try and ease the situation.
Hey, easy, Bobby Joe. I'm sure he doesn't mean anything personal by that remark. Not everybody likes Texas, nor are they expected to.
I just don't like being insulted by some bitch who doesn't know what he's talking about.
Let's just have our beers and get on our way.
After you apologize.
Apologize? You expect me to apologize my ass? What I'm gonna do, mister, is wipe up the floor with your sorry ass.
Bobby Joe put up his fists. The man in black smiled a smile without mirth.
If we're gonna fight, why don't we make it permanent?
He stepped away from the bar and flipped his jacket back, exposing a pistol that he wore low and kicked out in the way of a gunfighter.
Mr. Boone, I'm sure these boys would apologize to you if you just give them a moment to reconsider. There's no need to carry this any further.
My God, Bobby Joe, back off. Don't you know who this is? This is the man they call Gravedigger.
Bobby Joe realized now that things were beginning to go much further than he had intended. And he opened his fists and held his hands palm out in front of him.
Now, wait a minute. We don't need to be doing this. This is just a little dispute. It ain't worth either one of us dying over.
Oh, it won't be either of us, Sonny. It'll just be you. Both of you.
Boone looked at Donnie.
But when the shooting starts, I'm gonna kill both of you.
Neither Bobby Joe nor I have any intention of drawing on you. So if you shoot us, you're gonna have to shoot us in cold blood in front of these witnesses.
Oh, it ain't gonna be in cold blood. You'll be drawn on me. Both of you.
Donnie's knees grew so weak that he could barely stand and he felt nauseous.
Please, Mr. Boone, we don't want any trouble. Why don't you just let us apologize and we'll go on our way?
I give you boys the chance to apologize. You didn't take it. It's too late now. Pull your gun.
Donnie and Bobby Joe looked at each other. The two young men made desperate grabs for their pistols. They were slow. So slow that Boone had the luxury of waiting for just a moment to see which of the two offered him the most competition. Angus Boone put his pistol back in his holster. He was calmly sipping his whiskey by the time a few of the citizens of the town got up the nerve to look inside. By the time Matt reached 18 years old, he stood 6 feet tall, strong as an ox. The older Matt got, the narrower the difference between him and Smoke, in size, in quickness and accuracy with a handgun, and in just about any other attribute. Sometimes, for fun, the two would wrestle. And the winner depended not on strength or skill, but on whoever happened to achieve a temporary advantage in leverage or position. Also, the age difference between the two seemed less significant now, and the fatherly relationship gradually changed into one of big brother. The two continued to pan the streams, and the streams continued to be productive. For the entire time Matt lived with Smoke, they buried the gold each year, taking just enough into town to buy goods and supplies for another year. But in the spring of Matt's 18th year, they took it all into town. It took 4 pack animals to carry the load. When they cashed it out, the total went past $30,000, which was more money than the local bank had on deposit.
Well, we can have the money shipped down from Denver.
Can you write us a draft that'll allow us to go to Denver to get the money ourselves?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, of course I can do that. But you don't have to go to all that trouble. As I say, I can have the money shipped here.
It's no trouble. Denver's a big city. I think I'd like to have a look around. How about you, Matt?
I've never seen a big city. I'd love to go to Denver.
Write out the draft.
Very good, sir. And who shall I make this payable to?
Make it out to both of us. Kirby Jensen and Matt.
Smoke looked over at Matt.
I've never heard you say your last name.
Smoke, just make the draft payable to you.
No. What are you talking about? This is your money, too. You help pan every nugget.
You can pay me my share after you cash the draft.
It might be easier if it's made just to one man.
All right. Make it payable to Kirby Jensen.
The assayer wrote out the draft. He blew on it to dry the ink, then handed it to Smoke.
Here you are, Mr. Jensen. Just present this to the Denver Bank and Trust, and they will pay you the amount so specified.
Smoke held the bank draft for a moment and looked at it.
Hard to believe this little piece of paper is worth all that money.
I assure you, sir, it is as good as gold.
Smoke turned to Matt.
What'd he say, Matt? You ready to see Denver?
I'm ready.
Hey, watch where you're going.
Although some predicted Denver would reach the magic number of 100,000 inhabitants by 1870, the actual growth of the city fell far short of the mark. Editor William Byers of the Rocky Mountain News wrote an article about what he called the go-backers.
Because they cannot shovel out nuggets like they have been accustomed to digging potatoes, they raise the cry that it is all a humbug and take the back track for home, where it is to be hoped that they will ever after remain.
Despite Byers' complaint, the city seemed exceptionally crowded on the day Matt and Smoke arrived. It was certainly larger than any city Matt ever saw, and as they rode down Wincoop Street, they actually had to move aside frequently to allow coaches, carriages, and wagons to pass. Men and women walked briskly along the boardwalks on either side of the street, the women carrying parasols against the sun, the men wearing bowler hats and suits. On one corner, some musicians were playing a fiddle, banjo, and guitar, accompanied by someone blowing into a jug. People gathered around to hear them. Occasionally, someone would drop a coin into an upturned hat. A large banner stretched across the street. One corner of the sign had come loose and was flapping in the breeze, but Matt could still manage to read it.
Denver welcomes the Denver Pacific Railroad, June 24, 1874.
Shortly after they passed under the sign, they saw a building with a new sign proudly proclaiming it as the Denver Pacific Depot.
Have you ever seen a railroad train, Matt?
No, I haven't. Have you?
I used to see them back in Missouri when I lived there as a boy during the war. But I haven't seen one since.
I'd sure like to see one.
Well, according to the sign, the train will be here tomorrow. How would you like to come down here tomorrow to watch?
Yeah, sure, I'd like to very much.
Well then, we'll just do that. Now, what do you say we go get our money and get us a hotel room?
Sounds good to me.
The Denver Bank and Trust stood on the corner of Market and 17th Streets. Like most of the buildings in Denver, the bank was constructed of brick and positioned in such a way that the entrance was at the corner of the building. Like nearly every other building in town, red, white, and blue bunting adorned the entrance. Inside the bank, a Currier and Ives print hung on the left wall. The print showed 2 trains on parallel tracks. It looked as if the trains were racing each other. Smoke and steam streamed back from the engines, and the great drive wheels blurred in motion. People stood alongside the tracks waving at the engineers at work in their respective cabs, eyes staring ahead as they drove their iron steeds along the tracks. Beside the Courier Knives print hung a large printed sign. The Denver Bank and Trust welcomes the Denver Pacific Railroad. The three tellers in the bank wore the caps of railroad conductors as part of the celebration. Smoke stepped up to a teller window.
Yes, sir. What can I do for you?
Everyone seems excited about the arrival of the railroad.
Oh, yes, sir. We are indeed excited about it. By this time tomorrow, Denver will be a part of the railroad age. Why, did you know it'll be possible to board a train right here in our own fair town, and within less than 1 week be in San Francisco or St. Louis? What's more, it'll only take 2 weeks to travel all the way to New York City.
That's truly amazing.
Smoke took the draft from his pocket and slid it across to the bank teller.
I would like to negotiate this instrument, please.
Yes, sir. We will be glad to take care of...
The teller stopped in mid-sentence as he looked at the size of the bank draft.
Sir, this is a draft for over $32,000.
Yes, I'm aware of that.
But I don't know.
Is the draft not good? Does Colorado Gold and Silver Acceptance Company not have enough money to cover it?
Oh, I'm sure they do, but they aren't who I'm worried about.
Who are you worried about?
Well, I don't know if we have that much money in our reserve. Wait here, please. I must talk to the bank manager.
The teller started to walk away with a bank draft in his hand.
Uh-huh. We'll leave that here.
But Mr. Flowers will have to see it.
You bring Mr. Flowers here to see it.
Yes, sir.
The teller handed the draft back to Smoke. A few minutes later, the teller returned with a short, rotund man. Mr. Flowers had a flowing mustache that joined with his mutton chop sideburns. He had no chin whiskers or chin. His neck just sort of flowed up into his face.
Mr. Johnson, is it?
Yes.
This is quite embarrassing, but at the moment we don't have enough funds on hand to honor the draft. However, if you will give us 24 hours, I believe we will be able to transfer some funds from some of the other banks in town. On the other hand, if you would like to do so, you could open an account in our bank and leave the draft for deposit. I would suggest that as the better solution.
No, thank you. You go gather up the money. We'll wait for it.
Very good, sir. We'll have the money for you by tomorrow.
A thick layer of blue tobacco smoke hung just beneath the ceiling of the Lucky Strike Saloon. Normally, there were as many as 5 or 6 poker games going on at the same time, but now there was only one. All the other games had stopped, and the other players, the bar girls, and even the casual drinkers were drawn to the action at the remaining game table. Smoke had 3 piles of poker chips stacked in front of him, representing over $1,500 in cash. He pulled out a long, thin cigar and lit it, examining the man across the table from him. The man had just taken a seat at the table, attracted by the size of the stakes.
I'm told your name is Smoke Jensen.
It is?
You know who I am, Mr. Jensen?
Should I?
I'm a professional gambler, Mr. Jensen. My name is Kelly Smith. Does it make you nervous to be playing against a professional gambler?
No, not at all.
It should.
Really? Why is that?
I've been watching you for the last several minutes, Jensen. You are a reckless player. You play with emotion, not with your mind.
Smith put $1,500 on the table.
I think I should give you a few lessons, but I warn you, they will be expensive.
I've always heard that a good education is expensive. But I do seem to have a winning streak going.
Yes, well, I'm here to stop that winning streak.
I do admire a man with confidence.
Smoke raked in the cards and started to shuffle them.
No, don't use those cards.
Smith stuck his hand out to stop Smoke from shuffling the cards.
I'd like to play with a new deck of cards, if you don't mind.
I don't mind at all.
One of the bar girls standing nearby handed Smoke a new deck of cards, and he broke the seal and dumped them on the table. They were clean and stiff and shining. He pulled out the joker, then began shuffling the deck. His hands moved swiftly, folding the cards in and out until the law of random numbers became king of the table. He shoved the deck across the table.
Cut?
Smith cut the deck, then pushed him back. He kept his eyes glued on Smoke's hands.
5-card stud?
That'll be fine.
Smith won $500 on the first hand, and a couple of hands later was ahead by a little over $1,000. Smoke was ready to concede that his string of luck had run out. At that time, he was still almost $100 ahead. He finished his beer.
Well, I guess your ambition wasn't misplaced. You've broken my streak. Perhaps I should quit while I have something left.
Well, you have a lot more money than you are showing on the table, Mr. Jensen.
Smoke's eyes narrowed.
What are you talking about?
The whole town knows that you presented a bank draft today that was so large that the bank couldn't cash it. That is right, isn't it?
Mister, I figure whatever happens between me and the bank is my business.
Well, seeing as they're having to raise the money from all the other banks in town, seems to me like it's everybody's business now.
Smith looked at the $100 Smoke had remaining.
What do you say we play one hand a showdown for what you have left on the table?
All right.
Let the woman deal.
Smoke nodded and handed the cards to the bar girl who was standing by. She dealt 5 cards to each of them.
Your pair of fives wins, Mr. Jensen.
Within 3 hands, Smoke was back up to $800.
You've won 3 hands in a row. You can't possibly win a 4th. You have the guts to bet everything on another hand?
You know, Smith, there are only 2 of us playing at this table. Mathematically, that means the odds are 50-50 that I'll win.
So?
So, I mean, the fact that I've already won 3 hands does not lessen the odds of me winning again.
Smoke won with a pair of 10. Smith threw his cards on the table in disgust. He slid the rest of his money to the center of the table.
I got another 1,000 here. High card.
All right. High card.
The bar girl fanned out the cards on the table. Smith turned over a queen of hearts. He looked across the table and smiled triumphantly at Smoke.
Got you now.
Smoke turned up a king.
Well, it looks like my luck has returned.
Smoke reached for the pile of money.
You just ran out of luck, mister.
Smith pulled his pistol and pointed it at Smoke.
Draw your gun.
You may have noticed I'm not wearing a gun.
Hell, it don't matter whether you're armed or not. We hang card cheats here in Denver. I'll just shoot you and save the citizens the cost of a hangman.
The barrel of a pistol pushed against the back of Smith's head.
Put your gun down.
What?
Smith lowered his pistol and tried to look around, but the gun barrel prevented him from turning his head. Beads of perspiration popped out on his upper lip.
Who are you? What are you getting mixed up in this for? This ain't none of your concern.
My name is Matt. You just threatened to shoot an unarmed man, and that unarmed man is my friend. That makes it my concern. Now, put your pistol on the table, please.
Gingerly, very gingerly, Smith laid his pistol down on the card table. Smoke picked Smith's gun up, emptied all the cartridges, and then walked over to the stove, opened the door, and tossed the gun inside.
Have a nice walk around town, did you, Matt?
Smoke slammed the stove door shut.
Yes, I did.
I'm gonna cash in the chips. Then I suggest that we take our dinner at the most expensive restaurant in town.
Good idea.
Matt let the hammer down on his pistol and returned it to his holster. It wasn't until after the gun left his head that Smith turned to see who accosted him. He saw a strongly built youth of 17 or 18 with sun-bleached blonde hair and bright blue eyes.
Why, you're just a kid. You don't get yourself into trouble playing a man's game. I should have taken you.
Mr. Smith, have you ever tried to pick up a bobcat by his back legs? That's exactly what you would have run into if you had tried anything with my partner.
Really? Well, I guess now we'll never know, will we?
And you better hope that you never have to find out. Come on, Matt, let's go.
As Smoke and Matt left the saloon, they were poking money into all their pockets.
I've never seen so much money. How much did you win tonight?
About $2,500, I think. And if you think this is a lot of money, wait until tomorrow when we get our payoff at the bank.